How many people are feeling a little uncomfortable right now? How many people are feeling a lot uncomfortable right now? Okay, yeah, this story puts the lot in a lot uncomfortable. So we have a little visual aid because to debunk this story, to really unpack it. Oh, no, no, not that kind of visual aid. Oh, Lord. Okay. That is not what I meant. And shame on you for your dirty minds. Okay, so. So, how many people have heard references to Sodom and Gomorrah? Okay. There was a young man at a church I used to work at who was out and gay but was still in college, and his parents had thrown him out of the house. His grandparents allowed him to live with them, but only under the condition that he attended church every Sunday. And they went to a very conservative church, and they watched Fox News. And every night, almost every night, there was some reference to gay rights or gay marriage or something. And every single time, the news anchors would make a reference to Sodom and Gomorrah. And this is why Sodom and Gomorrah was destroyed. So we've all heard this story. How many of us have actually read this story? Not as many. Yeah. Okay. It's an ugly story. There's no way around that. And there's two problems with it. Two main problems. The first problem is that it's traditionally used to condemn homosexuals. Okay? This is a problem. The second problem is that it's understood to condone the brutalization of the daughters. Okay? This is a problem that for millennia people have said, you know, how could God condone something like that? How could God allow this to happen to women? How could God condone a father behaving that way? This is a problem. So, I'm going to ask you to suspend everything that you think you know about this story for the next 20 minutes. When I was taking Biblical Hebrew in my first year, for our final project, we had to translate 10 verses. Any 10 verses, we were allowed to pick whichever 10 we wanted. I chose this. I actually chose 11, the first 11 verses of this story. Because I have heard about this story so many times, and I've had it thrown like a weapon. Oh, yeah, well, Genesis 19. Oh, yeah, well, Sodom and Gomorrah. I've heard it so many times. I wanted to read it for myself in the original to find out what it actually said. So, in doing that, in translating it word for word for word for word, by studying the historical context, I discovered some things that I had never heard before. And when I looked into the scholarship, I discovered they had not discovered these either, at least not that I have found. So I'm going to present to you a theory. I'm going to present to you an argument, really. It's based in fact, it's based in evidence, but if you look around to try and find it elsewhere, you will probably not find scholarship saying, oh yes, everybody sort of modern scholarship believes. So I'm going to ask you to go with me on a little journey, and at the end you can tell me whether or not I have convinced you or not. So first of all, let's talk about the homosexuality problem. Because this story, they assume that when there's a group of men surrounding a house demanding that they throw men out so that they can have their way with them, so they can know them biblically against their will, that is homosexuality. That this concept of, you know, attack, violence, non-consensual brutalization of strangers, that's somehow indicative of homosexuality. And if we make the same comparison to heterosexuality, we would find that ridiculous. Gang rape of a woman is not the same as a loving, consensual relationship between two people, right? Okay, so let's just take, if you feel comfortable, a little show of hands. How many people here have met firsthand in their own experience or know of personally some sort of sexual predator? They know someone who maybe was harmed, or they know someone who was a molester or a rapist. They've actually met someone who does this. Go ahead and raise your hand. Either way, predator or victim. If they actually know of the predator, know well enough to know who the predator was. Okay. Of those predators, how many of them were homosexual? Zero. Okay, how many people have actually met a homosexual? Some of us more than one, okay? Yeah, go ahead, keep your hands up. Of all these people, think about them. How many of them to your knowledge, were sexual predators of some way. There you go. Okay, this story is not indicative of homosexuality, so we're just going to throw that right out. Okay? Based on our own experience, and in every single church I've ever preached this in, I have the same show of hands for the same questions. We have yet to find a single homosexual who behaves like the men in this story. It's not the same thing. It's not the same thing. So, let's go on. Let's go on. When we look at the book of Ezekiel and the book of Maccabees, they talk about Sodom's real sin. And this is fascinating. This was the guilt of your sister Sodom, says Ezekiel. She and her daughters had pride, excess of food, and prosperous ease, but did not aid the poor and needy. That is why God destroyed them. Maccabees says, so consumed with fire and sulfur, the people of Sodom who acted arrogantly, who were notorious for their vices. Nothing about sexual behavior. It was because they had so much stuff and they refused to share. There were people dying in their streets. So, when we look at this story, we have a lot of assumptions. We're going to move now to the problem of how Lot behaved towards his daughters and how God could condone behavior such as that. And we have a lot of assumptions about this story. And I did not realize when we have heard stories from the Bible again and again and again, heard references to them, learned them from Sunday school, hear them in the news, it's very easy to have assumptions we don't even realize are assumptions. And I had to dig deep when I was reading this story to realize that I was starting with base assumptions that were not necessarily facts. Let's go over some of these. The first assumption, Lot was a righteous man. The second assumption, does this make sense? Yes, Lot was a righteous man? Okay, we'll talk about that in a second. The second, that angels came to Sodom to rescue Lot and his family. That the angels came to Sodom to destroy it. And so then we end up with this conclusion, if Lot was a righteous man, then God condones his actions. Now, if we didn't assume that Lot was a righteous man, we would not have the question, how could God condone his actions? But people assume that they did, and I'll tell you why. So, what we're going to do is we're going to take all of these assumptions and we're going to turn them into questions and we're going to test them. Was Lot a righteous man? Did the angels come to rescue Lot and his family? Did the angels come to destroy Sodom? We're no longer treating these as facts. We're treating these as questions. So, let's talk about this. The reason why most people assume that Lot was a righteous man, and most people do, even if they don't even realize they do, because prior to this story, there's a conversation between God and Abraham. Many of you may be familiar with it. God says, the cry out from the people about Sodom and Gomorrah has been so great, I have decided to destroy the city. Think about that. People are praying so much about how bad this city is that God has heard an overwhelming cry and decided it's so bad he's going to destroy the city. And Abraham says, but God, what if in that whole city there's like 100 righteous people? Would you still destroy the city? Have you heard this? Would you still destroy the city if there's 100 righteous people? Would you destroy them along with the guilty? And God says, well, if there were 100 people, no, I wouldn't destroy the city. And Abraham pushes. He says, well, what about if there were 50 righteous people? What if there were only 50? Would you still destroy them along with the guilty? This is the same question we have every time we get into the death penalty, isn't it? What if we made a mistake? What if one person dies that shouldn't have died? Would you still have the death penalty? Same question. God says, well, all right, if there's 50, all right. So they keep going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Abraham whittles God down to 10 people. If you can find 10 people in that city that are righteous, would you still destroy it? And God says, no. So then, boom, we go right into, then the angels came into Sodom. One thing leads to another. They grab Lot and his family. They tear out of the city, and then they destroy it. And we think, wow, wasn't God smart? Wasn't God smart? God needed to destroy the city. God had decided to destroy the city, but he'd made this promise to Abraham. So if he goes in and grabs all those righteous people and takes them out, then he can destroy the city and not have to worry about breaking his promise to Abraham while still fulfilling his will. Makes sense, right? Are you still with me? Okay, so we assume, well, Lot must have been one of those few 10 people in the city that were righteous, him and his family. So that is the assumption. Let's test that assumption. First of all, the text never says Lot is righteous, and that's important because there are other texts that say characters are righteous. For example, Job. The narrator says Job is a righteous man. God says Job is a righteous man. Even Satan says Job is a righteous man. This guy is so righteous, he has uber righteous in front of his name with the little umlauts over the U. Okay, this is how righteous Job is. Lot, it does not say he was righteous. It never says that. When he greets the men, he does two things. First of all, he's hanging out at the city gate. He's got nothing to do but see who's coming in and who's going out. And when he treats them in a very strange way. He puts his face down on the ground. It's a very interesting position to put yourself in greeting someone. Even when they greeted kings, they did not greet kings that way. And he says, come back with me to my home and wash your feet. Wash your feet. Now, do you remember David? King David? And how he fell for Bathsheba. Bathsheba gets pregnant. So David decides his first plan is to bring Bathsheba's husband back from the front where he's at war, get him to go home and sleep with his wife, because if he sleeps with his wife and 9 months later people find out she's pregnant, he can say, well, it was the husband, right? So he brings Uriah back from the front. He says, guess what? You get a 3-day leave. You get to go home. Why don't you go home, see your wife, and wash your feet? Wash your feet is a euphemism in biblical Hebrew. It's a euphemism for having conjugal relations. It appears in the Old Testament. It appears in other documents. Wash your feet is a euphemism. And Lot runs up to these men, puts his head on the ground, puts his behind in the air, and says, why don't you come back to my place and wash your feet? Do you still think that Lot is a righteous man? He was married with children. Are we feeling a little uncomfortable? Yeah? Okay, bear with me. So, notice how when the angels come into town, how they greet Lot. Now, if we assume that the angels came to town to save Lot's family so that they could destroy the town, do you think that when they found him, they would say, oh, you're Lot, you're the righteous man we've been looking for. Come with us quickly, we're going to destroy the town. Do you think they might greet him that way? Do you think they might recognize him? I think they might recognize him. Instead, they do not. He says, come back with me to my home and wash your feet. And how do they respond? How do they respond? They say no. They say no. What else do they say? We would rather sleep in the town square. We would rather sleep out in the open in the middle of the street than go back to your house. Do you still think that Lot is a righteous man? If the angels would rather sleep in the town square, knowing everything they know about that town, knowing everything that could befall them, they would rather sleep out unprotected than go back to his house. So, then we have this little interlude. Somehow they end up back at his house anyway. How did they end up back at his house? He invites them. They say no. They end up back there. Do you remember? It says Lot insisted. Lot insisted. You can imagine what that would look like? Oh, no, it's fine. We have plenty. My wife's making a casserole. We'd love to have you. It's no problem. Come on. It'll be fine. Insisted, right? This is what we do with guests. Is that what you're imagining he did? Okay. So. We talked about what the angels did and did not say. So, then we come to our third assumption that we're testing. The angels came to Sodom to destroy it. Do the angels say they're coming to Sodom to destroy it? Do they tell that to Lot? They do a little later. They say, we've come to destroy this city. Get your family and get out. So they say they're going to destroy it. And then do they actually do that? Yes, it says God rained fire and brimstone all over the city down to the last plant. You still with me? Okay, so that assumption tends to be true. So here's what we have. Here's our questions. Was Lot a righteous man? What do you think?
Not so much.
No, he was kind of a, you know, planner. Yeah, at the very least, he was cheating on his wife when he had children at home. At the very worst, he was some sort of a predator. Second, did the angels come to rescue Lot and his family? That's a tricky one because they didn't say they did. They didn't seem to have that in mind until the very last second. But then they ended up doing it. So we'll hold, the jury's still out on that one. Did the angels come to destroy Sodom? The angels did not come intentionally to bring Lot, to rescue Lot and his family. Later they did, but they changed their mind. So this is what we have so far. Okay? These are our assumptions. So then we have a new conclusion. If Lot was not a righteous man, if Lot was just as bad as the rest of the men in town, if the angels came to destroy Sodom because of men like Lot, then God did not condone Lot's actions. Ah, there was one other thing I forgot to tell you. So, do you remember that part where Lot goes out to talk to the men and offers his daughters? And then the men attack, right? It says that they press, they threaten him. They say, oh, you came here as a sojourner, and you, how dare you tell us what to do? You're an illegal alien is what they call him. Right? You came here as a sojourner. You're not even from around here. How dare you judge us? We're going to be even harder on you than we would have been on these men. And then they pressed hard against Lot and against the door. What do you imagine that looks like? What do you imagine that looks like? Do you think Lot was in danger? Do you think they might have been violent towards him? Do you think they might have been pushing on him and beating on him a little? Yeah. Here's what I discovered when I translated this text from the original. The exact same verb that is used to describe those men pushing hard against Lot is the exact same verb that is used to describe how Lot insists that the angels come back. The same verb. So either the men outside the door were saying, oh, it's fine, let them out, it's great, we got cupcakes, it'll be cool, we got plenty. Or Lot was manhandling those men to get them back to his house. Pushing, shoving, their lives were in danger. He was beating on them a little bit to get them back. It's the same verb. You see that? Can you imagine how surprised I was when I realized that? Can you imagine if people understood this, how it might transform their questions? So then we assume that God did not condone Lot's actions because he was just as bad as the rest of the men in that town. So the new question becomes, why did the angels bother to save Lot at all? Isn't that a better question? Why would God bother to save Lot at all? He's violent. He's a predator. He's a jerk. Right? He's cheating on his wife. Why would God bother to save Lot at all? Who did God save? Who did the angels pull out? Who did God really pull out and rescue before the town was destroyed? Who did he rescue? The daughters. He rescued the daughters. Imagine angels that did not want to go in that house. They knew exactly what happened in that house. They came for a purpose. They were accosted by this guy. And in all this hullabaloo, they suddenly realize as they are in this home that there are two innocents. Two young women who have by some miracle survived living in this town this long. And realize that they do not deserve to die. That they're in a horrible situation and they need to get out. And the angels pull out the girls. And he brings Lot too. Lot's not the best companion. But at that time period, young, unmarried, teenage girls, can you imagine them trying to survive on their own? There's no way. They had to have a male companion. They had to have a protector. He wasn't the best protector, but he was the best they had at that time. And he pulled them out. And he pulled them out. Because our God is a God that notices the innocent, the oppressed, and the victims, and liberates them. Why did the angels bother to save Lot at all? Because he had a task to fulfill in helping people who needed God more than he did. So, we have this situation in a cave. It's a bad situation. Remember last week how I told you there was a girl who was reading the Bible, start to finish, got through Genesis 19, threw her Bible in the trash, and walked out of the church and never went back? That was this passage. That was that passage where they're in the cave. Now, here's what's interesting. When we read this story, we hear this story told where Lot had no idea what was going on. They forced the booze on him. He doesn't remember anything. It was all their fault. Look at how they were dressing like that and acting like that and trying to get him drunk, and he has no control over the fact that they went and got themselves pregnant. Does that sound realistic to you? Have you ever heard of girls behaving this way towards their father? How many people have known a teenage girl? They don't behave this way. They don't. They don't. But when there are sexual predators who are known to be liars, get caught in their actions because the townspeople suddenly realize the daughters are pregnant, what kind of stories do they tell? I was drunk. I had no idea. It wasn't my fault. Look at the way that they behaved. Imagine if the story was told from the point of view of the daughters. Daddy got drunk again. And we were all by ourselves, and we were scared, and we just lost our mother, and she wasn't there to protect us anymore. Totally different story. Totally different story. So, what's fascinating about this story is the redemption at the end, because they end up having sons that go on to be the leaders of nations, the Moabites and the Ammonites. And yes, they are scrapping it out with the Israelites all back and forth throughout the Old Testament. But they were leaders of nations, and who better to establish just societies than women who know what it's like when society is out of balance, when leaders are corrupt, when power has gone awry? Who better? Because when we look at what happens with the Moabites, we get to see sometime later who the Moabites become. Do you remember Ruth? Do you remember the book of Ruth? Ruth was a Moabite. Ruth was a woman who learned how to survive without a man. She learned how to hitch her wagon to a star, which was another woman, and work together to survive in fields out in the open where they could have been prey and they were not. They learned how to be strong together. They learned how to become self-sufficient together. They learned how to find a way that they could own land together, that they could support one another and survive and thrive together. She was a Moabite. She had learned how to do that because that is what those girls taught their sons, and that is what that society taught their daughters. A new way of being together, a new way of fighting for one another, a new way of being women in a society that was not necessarily friendly to them. And if you may recall, Ruth got married to a wonderful man and had a child who ended up being the great-great-grandfather of King David. Without Ruth, we never would have had Jesus. Without Ruth, without the Moabite, without this strong, intelligent, scrappy woman, loyal, hardworking, held her body as a vessel and as a temple, we never would have had Jesus Christ, who taught us how to be peaceful, how to be loving, how to be gentle, and how to hold each other with honor. Can I get an amen to that?